Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, brothers and sisters, dear listeners. Welcome to today's big chapter of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International, and a special welcome to our Radio Al Ansar listeners through the live feed. Well, I'm sure everything and on everybody's mind at the moment is about the coronavirus. Well, we spoke about it a few times on previous shows. Even last week, Brother AB discussed it with Brother Nazir Malik about the Umrah suspension, etc. However, and if you look at our local media and the first confirmed case that took place here in KZN 2 days ago, that there is a call for people not to panic. And I think it's a very important call, because it is important that we should not panic. However, does not mean that we must be complacent and not take necessary precautions and safety measures. And what we've seen here is that, unfortunately, and this is not only with coronavirus, it's with everything, that social media tends to get the better of people when they get carried away with some sort of fake news, and it becomes viral, as viral as the infection is. And that's where the problem comes about. So just to urge you listeners out there not to get carried away, to take it easy. As I said, take necessary safety measures and precautions. However, we should not panic. We have to carry on with our day-to-day lives. Yes, it is very bad where it is happening predominantly at the moment, especially in China and a few neighboring countries, Iran, Italy. These are the countries that are worst affected. And of course, we know what's happening in Saudi Arabia with the suspension of Umrah. And of course, this week where this was again fake news that went around that the Haram was totally closed. Both the Harams were closed, but actually it wasn't closed. It was again safety measures taken by the authorities to limit the inflow of people, for the simple reason is to make sure that especially the Mataf area, and that was sanitized, and that the Haram had to be closed after Isha till Fajr or to Hajjah time, etc. And of course to maintain an effective crowd control until such time, again, when these measures are in place, then they can resume activities as normal. I know a lot of people have been planning their Umrah trips, especially we got the upcoming first quarter, first term school holidays. People who go also in the month of between February and March in the off-season are all disappointed because of this cancellation announcement. But we must understand that when it comes to, and of course you'll get a lot of criticism by, pointed at the Saudi government. However, we must also understand that when it comes to crowd control and dealing with a multitude of people, the Saudis have got an excellent track record when it comes to this. And we just have to look at the Hajj, right, to see how it works. Whoever has been for Hajj will know this. Those who have gone for Umrah will have a vague understanding of it, because they haven't experienced what Hajj has to offer us. And those who haven't been should know that you're dealing with a multitude of people from all over the world. Right, and these people are just, they come from different backgrounds, from rural areas, from areas that are very, affected, with sorts of different kind of diseases. You know, like for example, the people who come from the Far East countries, they will have the problem of dengue fever. You know, just to give you an example, then you've got some areas that are malaria areas, people come from there. So you've got people who come from all over the world that converge here, and here you've got a country that allows up to 4 million pilgrims at the time in a small confined area like Mina, Muzdalifah, Arafat, and they are, there's medical personnel all around, there's army, there's name it, right? And they deal with this. And they have the experience. And they're always in touch with the relevant international health bodies, such as the WHO, etc., to keep up to date as to what is happening, so that they can be, proactive in dealing with the situation. So given this, when the country decided to announce a suspension of Umrah, it wasn't just a light decision that was taken. It was a very important decision that was taken because here you got, again, people converging. Now people, it's Umrah time, so people are converging, and where's the one place or the two points in Makkah and Medina where people will converge? In Medina, it's at the Prophet's Qabr. In Makkah, it's at the on the Mataf by the Kaaba. So what the government is saying that, look, we have to, this outbreak is there, okay, fine, there haven't been any positive cases yet in Saudi Arabia until the one case that was confirmed this week, but let's take our safety measures, let's make sure that whoever comes into the country has been screened at their point of departure, and as well as at the point of arrival in the country. And then we go from there. And this is very important. So this is what we are seeing right now. And once all the measures are in place, etc., then of course the government will lift the suspension. And inshallah, Umrah will resume. And of course, Ramadan is also coming up soon. People will be able to go for that, inshallah, and then Hajj as well. So I think when people are panicking and overreacting, please, you know what, at the end of the day, like yesterday, I give an example on two WhatsApp group chats. I forwarded a message from somebody who suggested that the Istima is happening soon. Now, we know the Istima happens in the major cities of Durban, Johannesburg. We know there's people converging there. And, okay, maybe the message was a bit crude in a way if one has to interpret it from a certain point of view, but said that people are coming together and perhaps they should look at suspending the Istima or at the very least postponing it. Now, the thing is that it was a forwarded message, and that already you found on these platforms people were getting emotional and carried away. Oh, how can this be? This is just a ploy to make sure that people don't go to the masjids and to, you know, to abandon the worship of Allah. At the end of the day, we're not saying don't go to mosque, don't go for Jummah, don't go and read your namaz. We're saying, like, for example, if you go to the masjid, make a wuzu at home, use the toilet at home, make a wuzu at home, go to the masjid. Read your salah, come back. Okay, so what is in is that here we have the Istima, which is of course a gathering of people, and alhamdulillah, when you have the Jummah for Istima, you have the largest crowd coming together, right? And people are there, but all it takes is for one or two people to have this nasty cough, and it can spread. And that's where the problem is. And the people are sleeping in tents openly. There's no barriers between them. Again, somebody has to have a nasty cough and it can spread. What we're saying is that proactive measures need to be taken. The challenge needs to be addressed. Okay? Nobody says cancel the Istima. Nobody says suspend the Istima. Said at the very least, if necessary, postpone it. But then again, it is not a decision for me or for you to make. It's for the elders of the Jamaat when they have the meeting, which they're going to have soon, because knowing that this is something very important, seeing what has happened in Makkah, seeing that around the world in certain countries where, you know, people are taking safety measures at masjids, etc., that this will be addressed and there will be some sort of wisdom and outcome out of this. So let's not get carried away. Anyway, let's go to other parts of what's happening here in South Africa and in the world. Well, we've seen here in South Africa, well, this week it was announced that South Africa is in a technical recession. Now, a recession comes about when every country has a forecast of quarterly growth. So you have four quarters in the year, and this you have this four quarterly forecast, economic forecast, and you have the GDP growth figures. And for two successive quarters, if there's negative growth, then technically speaking, that economy is in a recession. In other words, it is regressing. It is going backwards. South Africa, as they say, is in a technical recession. But a lot of people disagree, especially people in the business world. And I see Malema has also been vocal on it, that South Africa is not in a technical recession. South Africa is in a recession, and in a very serious recession, right? However, they must also take responsibility for it, as, you know, for causing this situation, because we can't seem to make headway. One moment back in 2017, when Pravin Gordhan was fired unceremoniously by Jacob Zuma, the EFF were rallying behind him and said, how can you take out our finance minister? And he's trying to do things like, then now he's in the current government, and then the same EFF wants him out because he works unilaterally and he's basically benefiting his friends and cronies, etc., to the point that they disrupted parliament at Sona this year and said they want him out. So at the end of the day, no matter what, the EFF must also take responsibility for allowing this country to go into recession because of the silly policies. Right? But the ANC ultimately at the end of the day is to blame because they are the ruling government. And there's been a lot of infighting, and that's the biggest problem, the political infighting, where we have a president who is determined to clean up house. Unfortunately, given the situation and the challenges posed to him, he cannot do so because of the different camps within the ruling party. Okay, and we all know where that is prevalent from. You've got the state capture fight back cabal, you've got the current cabal of those who want to work on a national sentiment, and you've got those who are committed to seeing the country recover. So what do? We have the serious dilemma and we need to deal with it. So all we say is that at the end of the day, we have to just be steadfast. Every time we're hoping for somebody to be charged or for some trial to take place or somebody to go to prison, we don't see any of that. Yes, we see lots of commission of inquiries taking place. And there are certain times when there's a ruling in a commission of inquiry. But really speaking, what's the outcome to that? And looking at what our experience here in South Africa, and there's no need to delve in it, especially during the Zuma era, etc., and the state capture period. But there's a very interesting parallel that if people have noticed that has been taking place on another part of the world, and that's a Muslim country, in a Muslim country that many of us hold dear for various reasons, especially me, because I guess I spent a year there. But Malaysia is a country that is having a problem, and a very serious problem. And again, a lot of similarities and telltales where one can see where this challenge is coming from. Right now, Malaysia is going through a serious political crisis. Last week, the Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who in his second term of almost 2 years resigned because of a political party fallout, and then his party colleague, Mohidin Yassin, is now the Prime Minister. Mohidin Yassin is basically like how we had Khalema Motlanthe when he came in, when Thabo Mbeki had to resign, you know, one of those low-profile candidates coming in there and trying to, you know, run the show. However, you have to look at what's happening, and this has to do with the Najib Razak era, who was the Prime Minister prior to May 2018 when he lost the elections. Now, if you look at a bit of the history of the country got independence in 1957 from Britain. And the ruling party in Malaysia has been the United Malays National Organization, which is part of a broad coalition known as the Barisan Nasional or the National Front. And the National Front, the coalition made up of the UMNO, which is the United Malays National Organization, the MCA, the Malaysian Chinese Association, and the MIC, the Malaysian Indian Congress, and a few other small political parties. And they were the ruling power in the country from 1957 to 2018. Now, you can imagine that's a very long time. That's 61 years that they were ruling the country. And then comes in the elections of May 2018, led by former Barisan National Chief, former UMNO President, former Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, who turns, by the way, in July this year, 95 years old, at the age of 93, coming in to rescue his country from what he says has been a point of no return. In fact, that's where the country went to. So here you have the situation, and what caused it? It was one of the most scandalous situations to ever rock a country in modern history. It was known as the 1MDB, right? The 1MDB, meaning 1 Malaysia Development Berhad. That's the name of the company. 1 as in number 1, Malaysia Development Berhad. Berhad is Malay word for limited. 1MDB was formed in 2015 by the Malaysian Finance Ministry for growth for the country and to take the country into another dimension. However, there was a lot of how can we put it this way, a lot of irregularities, and that all surfaced since Mahathir came into office in 2018 and immediately opened up the 1MDB probe, including seizing assets of Najib Razak, the former Prime Minister, putting a travel ban on him, and a very lengthy court case which has been taking place. And now look at the similarities here in South Africa. We had a change of government and we saw suddenly Zuma has to go to court, even if it was court appearances, etc. But no trial yet underway. But in Malaysia, a trial is underway. And it's not just Najib, it's his wife Rosma, it's a few of his cronies, leading cronies. In fact, one of them is a leading Chinese guy called Zhou Low, and he's a wanted fugitive. And it's quite a serious problem. But what happened was that how Mahathir came into power is that he quit the ruling party, UMNO, a few years ago because he was disgusted with Najib's leadership and the way he was in the direction he was taking the country. And he had to make an alliance with his former foe, Anwar Ibrahim, who was in prison at the time. He was in and out of prison. In fact, in 1998, due to the fallout with Mahathir, he went to prison. Then he was released in 2004. Then he rose again to fame in politics with his wife Wan Aziza and his daughter. And then he went back into prison. So when he went back into prison the second time, that's when Mahathir formed an alliance with him, and to the shock of many, and said, "No, we need to fight this state capture that we are going through in this country." And they did so, and so much so they formed this alliance. So the Justice Party of Anwar Ibrahim, known as Keadilan, then you had a party which then Mahathir formed called Parti Pribumi Bersatu Malaysia, meaning the National Indigenous Malaysian Party, right? And a few other small parties, they've got together and decided to form a coalition known as Pakatan Harapan, meaning the Alliance of Hope, and contest the 2018 elections, which they won, and Mahathir was able to be the Prime Minister since between May 2018 and now till the end of February 2020, almost 2 years. However, last week, due to a lot of backstabbing, etc., he resigned because out on principle, and brought the entire coalition into disrepute. So much so that the next day he got sworn in as the interim prime minister. However, there was a lot of pressure to make sure that a proper prime minister comes in, and not to have unitary politics or etc. So because that they didn't want a benign dictatorship. So at the end of the day, eventually his colleague, who is party president Mohidin Yassin of the same party, Pribumi Bersatu Malaysia, then was sworn in over the past weekend by the King of Malaysia as the Prime Minister. Anyway, we're taking a short break now. It's 11:30. We'll continue shortly thereafter. Okay, so welcome back, listeners. So we were talking about Dr. Mahathir and the Malaysian election. So what happened was that eventually the king then appointed Mohidin Yassin to come in as prime minister. But Dr. Mahathir is still very unhappy about it, for the simple reason is that he feels that Mohidin has been supported by the former party, which is UMNO, and they're all ex-UMNO members, right? For the simple reason is that this is a fight back. Again, state capture fight back. Exactly. This is a fight back by the former... by Najib Razak and friends, because if the call process concludes successfully, the anti-corruption investigations and inquiries conclude successfully, then all these guys who are involved that were with Najib will eventually face trial and will be locked up. And that's what you have, and that's what we see here in South Africa as well. So if you look at the parallels, I mean, the amount of money that was lost, or should I say that the 1MDB, the losses incurred by 1MDB amount to 42 billion Malaysian ringgit, which is the equivalent of 10 billion US dollars, which in South African rands is about 155 billion rand. That's how much was siphoned off. Okay, of which Najib Razak has been the recipient of something to the figure of 700 million Malaysian ringgit. Okay, 700 Malaysian ringgit, should I say, in the region of about, say, between 150 to 200 million US dollars, in the region of about, say, close 2.5 to 3 billion rand that found its way to his accounts alone. And this is where the problem lied. So the thing is that, and he says that this is money that he's earned. He has always been a politician. He's always been in politics. He was a minister during the Mahathir era. He was then deputy prime minister after Mahathir retired back in late 2003 when Abdullah Ahmad Badawi became prime minister in 2003-2004. He was the deputy to Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, and then in 2008-2009 he became prime minister of the country. So how does a prime minister, not even Mahathir, who was prime minister for 22 years in his first tenure, and now again 2 years in this second tenure, never even accumulated such wealth of 700 million ringgit, or should I say, in the region of, say, 2.5 to 3 billion rand. That's how ridiculous this is. So this is the situation here we have in Malaysia, and in, as I said, you've seen some very interesting parallels. And again, a head of a country who ran the country for almost 10 years in that country. And then we have here in South Africa with Zuma. You have also the story, 9 to 10 years, and benefiting only cronies and friends and family. And this is a very sad tale of events. And to think that this is happening in a Muslim country is even worse, because at the end of the day, people are governed, should be governed by the Iman. And we think it's only happening in the Middle East countries, or in the Pakistan, Bangladesh, but unfortunately it happened in one of the known as to be the most progressive amongst Muslim societies in a country like Malaysia, and the fight still carries on. So this is what's been happening there. Looking at the situations elsewhere, well, we've you know, of course, we know what's happening in India, and again, it's been a very taxing week on the people. It's now more and more details are emerging that this was actually a religious pogrom against Muslims, and that the RSS had allowed 2,000 people to come into Delhi and run havoc and target Muslim homes and businesses. Unfortunately, those Hindus that were neighboring the Muslims were also targeted, and they are fed up. So this is what's been happening in India. Will India stop the CAA? Let's be realistic. Very unlikely. Will India go back? Will India allow autonomy against two, or semi-autonomy against two, again for Kashmir? Very unlikely. So this is the country is moving into the right-wing fascism. In fact, it's already in the right-wing fascism state, and it just perpetuates. So this is where it stands with India at the moment. Apart from a few news reports surfacing, it has been a relatively quiet week compared to last week. However, it's still very disturbing. Then you have, of course, in Saudi Arabia, and this has been breaking news. In fact, this has been between last night and today. We all know what happened back in 2017, after Donald Trump made his first official visit as U.S. president out of the country, and he went to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and he tried to obviously push his way with a deal with all the Gulf countries, and the country that of course refused him was Qatar. And we know what happened immediately after that. We saw the Qatar blockade took place, and also the crackdown amongst by MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince, against his fellow cousin princes and other business leaders, including Prince Walid Al Talal, etc., and detained them in the five-star hotels, it's under house arrest, and etc. Eventually, once the deals were concluded between him and whoever he locked up, they were eventually released one by one and allowed to go on with their lives. And one of the conditions were that whoever, like Prince Walid, if you notice since then, he has kept a very low profile. In fact, that's been my observation, but others have also seen this too. And again, he is now struck again, of course, using his father, King Salman, who is an old man who suffers from dementia. So although it's the article goes around that King Salman's brother and nephew have been detained by his decree, but actually the thing is that the person behind this is Mohammed bin Salman. And what has happened was Mohammed bin Salman. And what has happened that the two leading princes, one is King Salman's very own brother, Prince Ahmed bin Abdul Aziz, and one of his nephews who is Prince Mohammed bin Naif. Now, Prince Mohammed bin Naif was the crown prince prior to Mohammed bin Salman. And then what happened when King Salman came in, he, of course, at the behest of MBS, had Mohammed bin Naif removed and brought in Mohammed bin Salman. So these two have been now arrested and have been accused of treason. And it's going to be a very interesting way forward to see what's happening here, because eventually what you notice is that Mohammed bin Salman has neutralized all those opposing him to be the next on the throne. And that's his aim. His aim has always been, since his father has appointed him crown prince. Crown prince is effectively the next in line, okay, and is basically the prime minister or president of the country. Okay, so this is what you're going to be seeing. And of course, people talk about it happened at one stage in the Ottoman Empire era where, the greedy sultans had this notion that whoever is in line for the throne, especially if you had several children, and if the one is in line and he becomes the successor, immediately he has all his siblings and cousins killed for the simple reason that they cannot challenge them to the throne. And unfortunately, there's a very dark era of the Ottoman Empire, and there were even the ulama that were supporting such a move until it was eventually stopped for various reasons. So you see these sorts of things that are taking place, and it doesn't end there. And looking at other issues, an important development, but it may be symbolic, but again, it makes some difference. There has been, of course, with the Rohingya, a call by human rights bodies around the world and activists to have the Nobel Peace Prize taken away from Aung San Suu Kyi, right? And this started 3 years ago the call has been started 3 years ago to have this award been taken away. Eventually, the City of London, okay, known as the City of London Corporation, this past Thursday decided to revoke an honor which it granted to Aung San Suu Kyi over the treatment of the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. Now, representatives of this body that run London's historic center and financial district, of which the mayor Sadiq Khan, is the Lord Mayor, decided to revoke the freedom of the city which it granted to her 3 years ago. And this is in line with the recent ruling by the International Court of Justice, which we discussed back in January when I interviewed one of the Rohingya activists here, whereby, again, it was a symbolic ruling. However, there has been significant strides towards making sure that the trial goes ahead. And one of the a leading human rights lawyer, and of course a celebrity, and of course the wife of a leading celebrity, George Clooney, the wife known as Amal Clooney, or formerly known as Amaluddin, who is a human rights attorney, has taken up the case for the Rohingya in the trial that will go forward. So at The Hague. So you saw that there's hope there. And of course, in Palestine, we have what took place, the third elections by the Israelis. Now, in a matter of less than a year, the first election took place in August 2019, the second election in September 2019, and now the third election. And in all three elections, Netanyahu's party, the Likud party, got the most votes, right? However, he has still failed, even in this election victory, right? He has still failed to get the majority he needs to form a coalition government. Sorry, he's got the majority of the most votes as as what it is in Parliament, and he has the first prerogative or the first priority to form a coalition government. But again, if you look at the patterns, outcome of April 2019 and September 2020, he's failing again to form a coalition government. And if you look at the Israeli politics, it's a very, whether you kind of call it a comic show, it's a very interesting situation because you've got so many factions, right? You know, I've heard, and I'm sure some of you have also heard this, that Israel is a vibrant democracy. In fact, in Israel, one can, I mean, I'm talking among the Israelis, the privilege that's to the Israelis. Remember, not to the Palestinians, but to the Israelis. You're allowed to speak out, you're allowed to challenge, you're allowed to say what you want to. They allow that privilege, yes, because they want to show the world that we are the best democracy, we're the only democracy in the Middle East, and, you know, we are very serious on these principles. So what you've been seeing is you've been seeing a lot of factions. You've got ultra-right-wing, you've got right-wing, you've got centrist right-wing, then you've got center, then you've got center-left, then you've got left-wing and ultra-left-wing, right? And all of them believe in the existence of the state of Israel reign supreme. All of them have treat the Palestinians basically like second-class citizens, right? Okay, all of them are guilty of the occupation. Okay, so why, where is this difference coming on? Is it because of each one has their own group of cronies and you know, want to do their own rounds of cronyism and nepotism during their rule? Yes, this is what it is. Who is in charge, obviously, runs the show and runs the show the way they want it. And Netanyahu, no matter what, even though he failed to form that government in April 2019, in September 2019, and the chances now, because he was the man in charge, or because his party was running the country and it was the under his prime ministership and the ministry served under his prime ministership, the status quo remains as a caretaker government. He is actually almost a year now running the country as a caretaker prime minister. Okay. However, you must know that each of these elections have been 6 months apart. The amount of damage that has been done in each of the 6 months period has been unbelievable. And it's just getting worse. And each time he fights an election, he uses the same rhetoric like what we saw with what the BJP has done in India. Of course, the BJP has taken the cues from Israel, but you can see that the emphasis is against the Palestinians, against expansion of the West Bank, of settlements, against the backdrop of the occupation of the entire West Bank. Okay, and to basically to do away with whatever autonomy that the Palestinians enjoy. And then, of course, you see from the Palestinian camp, especially with the Fatah ruling government, that Mahmoud Abbas will say, well, this is the end now and no more, and this is a story, but nothing happens. He'll talk and bark and say, right, call it a day. And the thing is, we are waiting for him. Call it today and say, right, okay, we Palestinians are no longer ruling and we are sitting at home and you Israel take care of it. And that will be the biggest nightmare for Israel. Because one of the things that benefits Israel the most with the current Fatah-led government is the Palestinian security forces that are between East Jerusalem and the parts of the West Bank where they run to keep, not to protect the Palestinians, to keep the Palestinians in check for the benefit of the settlers. And that's just one part of it. There's so many other, I mean, we don't have to go back into detail. A lot of us have the understanding of what the occupation about, what is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict about, but this is where you've seen it. So at the end of the day, we want to see a change in government, but really speaking, who will be the change? We had in the last two elections, Benny Gantz, that was the next in line, or came up with the second amount of votes, right? He speaks a less of a right-wing talk than Netanyahu, okay? But at the end of the day, they're still there. They're still moving in the same direction. One, maybe if you're looking at going into a northwest direction, for example, right? You got between north and west, they're moving in the northwest direction. One is moving north of northwest, and the other one is moving west of northwest. That's the difference. But they're all still moving in the northwest direction. Just to give you an idea. Benny Gantz has got blood on his hands. He was the general in charge when the Gaza war took place, when the bloody Gaza war of 2014 took place, where the most amount of fatalities happened, right? He was the army general. Then he decided to retire from the army and enter politics. Okay, then you've got the ultra-right-wing party of Avigdor Lieberman, who is known as the famous nightclub bouncer, the turned rogue settler politician. Okay, he served as Ministry of Foreign Affairs, he served as Minister of Defense, etc. He was seen to be the right hand of Netanyahu. Eventually, him and Netanyahu couldn't see eye to eye, and again, on each of these election outcomes, refused to work with each other. Of course, why Netanyahu is so determined to stay in power is because of the scandals that surround him. He's also had his, whether it's through his wife, etc., involved in corruption scandals, in putting the hands in the till, ill-treating of people, staff, etc., doing people down, and has got these corruption charges hanging over his head, and he's tried every effort to stall the process. Eventually, it came to a point whereby if all the parties, even now with this current election outcome, if all the parties that he's basically, if all the parties apart are outside the Likud, if they all have to vote together, damning Netanyahu to impeach him, they can do it. But the problem is, because of the infighting, some people will abstain, some parties will say, right, we're going for Netanyahu. Others will say, okay, let's vote for him, because they realize at the end of the day, if we take out, especially the right wing, and those all in the right wing, will realize that at the end of the day, if he is not there, then, you know, we got no chance. I mean, take a guy like Lieberman, he's got far fewer votes compared to what the Likud party has. So in his case, he would, although he bickers and things like that, and he doesn't want to be part of the be a minister in the cabinet, etc. But when it comes to loyalties of this kind, they will stand together. And this is what you've seen here that's happening. And it's a very sad situation. So we have to see what's going to be taking place there in the Palestinian landscape soon, and then look at the outcomes from there. Now, coming to a lot of people have been asking about what's happening in Syria. Well, the thing is that one of the reasons why personally I don't like to discuss the Syria conflict on air is because I have my views, and again, I don't, the views that I express here, and I want to make it clear to the listeners, is that it is my personal views and not the views of Radio Islam or Radio Al-Ansar or Brother A.B. Dawji, or for that, the standpoint of the big picture. So we try to avoid these sensitive topics for the simple reason is that they are divergent views and they can be, misconstrued in the wrong way. But just to give a bit of an outline of to what's happening, especially with the Turkish intervention. According to the Turkish government, that the reason why they have intervened in Idlib is because civilians are coming under fire from the Assad regime forces. And that has been already established. So the thing is that they are there to keep the Assad regime in check. Now, there has been, the talk that this is going to, of course, be blown into a full-scale war. But fortunately, with sense and sensibility, a last-minute meeting was called up this week in Russia between Erdogan and Putin, and Erdogan went to Moscow to see Putin, and they sat down and discussed and decided to agree on a ceasefire, which is currently holding. And let's see if there's if sanity prevails. Again, you've got a serious situation whereby a lot of people have been running away and displaced, and need to get away from this war zone. So one of the countries they will enter is Turkey. And Turkey has now decided from last week that enough is enough, because the EU had made promises to Turkey that if you keep the refugees within your borders or behind Turkish borders, in other words, do not let the refugees into Europe, we will aid Turkey with so many millions of hundreds of millions of euros to assist for the refugees. However, what is agreed is one thing and what is being delivered is another thing. And unfortunately, apart from a little that has come from Germany, really speaking, the EU has reneged on this deal. So Erdogan got fed up and decided to open the borders to Europe and allow the refugees that want to leave Turkey to go to wherever they feel they need to go, whether it's Southern Europe, Central Europe, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, wherever they feel they have a future. And that's what's been happening. And of course, the entry points into Europe are basically through the neighboring countries, Greece,
Bulgaria, Hungary, etc. And we know that the Hungarians have been dead against this, coming up with their own kind of walls, etc. And government saying that we don't want Muslims. Bulgarians have been still a bit okay. And the Greeks, of course, Greece is in a country that's in financial turmoil. But they know that the refugees are using the country as a transit point. However, suddenly we've seen in Greece an emergence of ultra-right-wing nationalism, and they are, of course, being a stumbling block and attacking refugees that are crossing the border into the country. And of course, the situation will just get out of control. And with Brexit now in place, of course, the one country that will be of that won't be a destination option for the refugees, unfortunately, will be Britain. When it was part of the EU, they still had a chance to get to Britain, but not at the moment. So again, we have to see what unfolds there in time to come. There's been a very interesting article regarding the war in Syria, and this is something that I try to tell people from the time the war broke out in when the uprising started in March 2011 and subsequently with the war shortly thereafter. Now, if we put the situation into perspective, if many of you remember the Arab Spring and the process it started, it started off with the, in January 2011, with Tunisia, with the one food street vendor who set himself alight because he was fed up of the red tape and the corruption in having the right to sell his goods. Shortly, it spilled over into Egypt, and we know the famous Tahrir Square uprising, and on the February 2011, Mubarak stepped down and came in the Ikhwan, and thereafter, immediately, the effect went into Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, and Syria. Of course, Syria went into full swing from a month later in March 2011. And I have been observing very closely Bashar al-Assad's demeanor and ways in which he, responds to all this. Whether it was a, just a report by any reporter, whether it was on Press TV, Al Jazeera, other online news, whether it was an interview he gave, whether it was a press conference, and he kept on harboring on the same points about a war on terror, about armed gangs, etc. And if you recall, post 9/11, back in 2010, years prior to that, right, the Bush, Blair, Cheney narrative, George W. Bush, Tony Blair, Dick Cheney narrative on the war of terror, on the war on terror, it was a very similar narrative that was being echoed by Bashar al-Assad. Now, I'm not here, as I said, to take sides. I'm giving you a perspective, and a very important perspective which you need to think about. I'm not here to, although I have my points, and whoever follows me on social media will know where I stand, but I'm just relating something very important, because this article that has come out sheds light on this, to say that how did the world buy Assad's war on terror narrative, right? Since the start of the uprising in Syria, even before it turned into a civil war, dictator Bashar Assad used the words terrorism and extremism instead of civil war. He denies, and even up to today, the existence of a civil war in the country and says that Syria is just fighting terrorists who are either living in Syria or have come from abroad and are supported by other countries like Turkey and the US with the sole aim of destabilizing the country, or what is popularly touted out there, regime change. Terrorism, as we know it, has been the most prioritized security issue since 9/11. Since 2014, a series of deadly attacks by Daesh in the West further fueled fear about terrorist incidents, and refugees have since become scapegoats of Daesh's terror. Since there is no universal agreement about the right usage of the terrorism label, it is easy to portray any group and person as a terrorist. Assad has used this loophole, systematically rejecting the label of civil war between two domestic groups is an example of narrative contests that work as a propaganda machine and is used as a tool to change the course of interstate conflict. Assad, too, did not accept the ongoing hostilities in Syria. Instead, he even went on to draw a parallel between what's happening in Syria and Daesh terrorist attacks in Europe. In 2015, for instance, he compared Daesh attacks and bombings in Paris to daily violence routine in Syria. He said that France had felt what they had been going through in Syria. However, when Daesh attacked Turkey, a country that Assad accused of supporting opposition groups in Syria, he was silent. It was a strategy to make the Western world believe that he was not evil, but the opposite was. He tried to depict them as terrorists and radicals, as he has since day one. And that is correct, because I've noticed that since March 2011 when this has come out. Some countries, even the USA, was ready to buy it, and they shifted their priorities in Syria. Instead of working on stabilizing the country, they initiated two more fights in the region. While they chose to back the outlawed PKK's Syrian offshoot, the YPG, in their fight against Daesh, and we spoke about the YPG last year, right? They also overlooked the PKK's goal to bring the war inside Turkey through its borders. However, Daesh and the PKK did not fight each other in Turkey, they attacked it together. According to the former Barack Obama administration, Assad became the least worst option in Syria in 2014 when it came to protecting U.S. interests. For Washington, Assad was the lesser of two evils when they compared the Assad regime to Daesh. At first sight, it might look like this is the U.S. policymakers' idea, but in fact they were tricked by Assad's own narrative. Iran and especially Russia spread the narrative on social media, underlining that Assad was fighting terrorists, not civilians. However, he didn't have one single battle with Daesh. He chose to kill as many opposition figures as possible, ignoring how many civilians were killed in the meantime. As the Nazi Joseph Goebbels said, you repeat a lie often enough and it becomes a truth. Before Daesh emerged and played its catalyzer role very well, he most probably hoped that his counter-terrorism narrative strategy would help him avoid a fast defeat. Daesh was a prize for Assad, as he was desperately seeking ways to defame the opposition. Now, if you go to my Facebook page under my name, Mustafa Darsod, or my Twitter account under my Twitter handle, at MMDarsod, you'll see that I posted this article yesterday. It is from the Turkish newspaper, English newspaper, Daily Sabah. How did the world buy Assad's war narrative? I urge you readers listeners to please read this article so you can get an understanding of where the war rhetoric comes from. Again, it's not there to take sides, but for Assad to have labeled the civilians that stood up against him and rose against him as terrorists is wrong. Yes, the outside fighters that come in are terrorists, but at the same time, he allowed Iran to bring in outside fighters as well, and Hezbollah, and they also doing the role of a terrorist? That is the question one needs to think about. Anyway, that's all we have time for today. We'll continue next week, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.